Welcome to Lexis, the podcast all about language and linguistics. I'm Lisa Casey.
I'm Jackie Glancy.
I'm Raj Rana.
And I'm Dan Clayton. So on this episode of Lexis, we're really pleased to welcome Charlotte Taylor, who is Professor of Discourse and Persuasion at the University of Sussex. So welcome, Charlotte. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Charlotte, you've worked in corpus linguistics for most of your career. What does corpus linguistics let you do that other methodologies don't?
Well, I don't know if I'd want to say that other methodologies don't allow you to do these things, but I guess the things that I really like about corpus linguistics are, first of all, it lets you look at more data than you'd be able to do easily using other methodologies. And it's not just, okay, I've got more, that's better, but it's like, I've got more and I can do different things with it. So the project I've been working on most recently, I was looking at over 200 years of reporting on migration. And without the corpus linguistics, I just wouldn't have been able to look at all of that. You know, I looked at every year for that whole period. Mm-hmm. And without corpus linguistics, I'd have had to sample. And the problem with that is that when you start sampling, you're already saying something about the data. You're going, well, based on this previous research or on this set of statistics, I'm going to select these years and look at these years. And so that predetermines what you can find. And so migration is a really good example of that, I think, because people might say, oh, well, have a look at the periods when migration was had the highest levels, when there were peaks of migration. But that's not how it works with newsworthiness, right? Or even in terms of political discourse, there actually isn't any parallel when I've looked at it between the peaks of actual migration, where we can get those statistics, and the peaks of newsworthiness. So I'd have been looking at the wrong years if I just started off with when was migration highest. So corpus linguistics was great because I could look at the whole period and go, okay, this is when there was loads of discussion around migration. Why? What were the triggers for that? And then the other way around, you can go, well, is migration framed differently when we're looking at the troughs, when actually it's just not really considered that newsworthy? So I think that was a really important thing with corpus linguistics is it doesn't limit what you're going to look at, so you can be surprised by the data in some way. And I'd say the other sort of major advantage really is that this idea that things look different when you look at a lot of it at once, or Susan Hunson talks about the way that corpus linguistics software rearranges the data so the latent patterns become visible. And so it's not that you're creating patterns by rearranging the data, it's that you're seeing things you might not be able to see, either when you're looking at it sort of close up, doing that really close text analysis that is so important, but you're just going to see something different. And so that's what I also really like, that you can kind of look at the data through a different lens and see something different that's in the data, but you're just able to spot it.
My first sort of exposure to corpus linguistics was a very sort of limited form of it, was like just crunching poems, for example, in literature, and like keywords and like seeing frequency and word clouds. And it, like you say, it just gives you a totally new perspective, doesn't it? You see things in a poem, and then I guess, you know, even bigger stretches of text that you'd never see.
Absolutely. And as you know, when you start looking at things through the prism of collocuts, you know, the words that go together with the word that you're looking at, and you see things that might have been just like slightly further away in the text than you were thinking of looking at when you were doing your analysis, or that you just hadn't realized these were recurring things coming up. And then that directs your attention to go, oh, that's interesting. What is going on with that one?
Yeah. And as you say, some of your recent work has been focused on discourses around migration. And so I think there's your 2021 paper, isn't there, on metaphors of migration over time, which is really interesting and we've kind of recommended to students before. Can you tell us a bit about some of the main discourses at work then and how these might have kind of changed or not and how they relate to maybe some of those sort of peaks and troughs that you talked about?
Okay, yeah. So I'll start with sort of the main discourses. And while I'd always want to talk about discourses because there are lots of different ways of framing and talking about migration that are present at the same moment in time, I'd say if we're thinking about the UK context, thinking about, you know, mainstream media discourse and political discourse, there are a lot of shared features across those different discourses. And so I would say the kind of first feature is one of partiality. So when we talk about discourses of migration in that UK context of political and media discourse, actually, we're not talking about migration at all. We're talking about immigration. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's difficult to get clear statistics on these things, but there's probably around 5 million UK citizens resident outside the UK. And that is really not part of our discourse of migration, whichever one we're looking at in the mainstream, right? Yeah. They're just erased from that whole debate. And I guess the other thing in terms of partiality is really about who gets foregrounded. So the second highest national group of non-British residents in the UK is people from Ireland. And again, I don't think this is particularly foregrounded in terms of who is thought of in these discourses of migration. So there are a lot of things that kind of hold these discourses together. So that would be one, this issue around partiality, I guess. The other thing is that I'd say our contemporary discourses of migration really rely on this myth. There is such a thing as this kind of stable, homogenous host population, which is distinct and different from this kind of erratic, other, highly mobile population. And of course, that's not actually how it is. Most of us have experiences of migration, either direct experiences, you know, I've lived abroad in Italy, I'm from the north of England, I live in the south of England, or you've got experiences in your family. You know, my family history is some of them, grandparents come from Ireland, some come from Wales. If I think of the generation below that, I have aunts living in New Zealand and Australia. You know, we have a lot of experiences of migration typically, and that kind of gets minimized as well, I'd say, in those big discourses. And then more specifically, I suppose, honing in on the mainstream discourses of migration, which, as I said, tend to be immigration, is this framing of migration, immigration as a problem. And this is, you know, really broad. And then it's realized through more specific discourses where immigration is framed as a cultural threat, often in religious terms, which I think is very relevant at the moment, in economic terms, and also in social terms, often with framings around criminality and so on. So I think those, you know, individual discourses all feed into that broader framing of immigration framed as a problem for the host population, essentially. The other thing that really kind of holds them together is this distinction between the idea of the undeserving migrant and the deserving migrant. And the undeserving migrant is the one who's framed as being the threat. And the deserving migrant is this sort of very, very narrow, small proportion of that. And who is typically never here and now, that's somebody who existed in the past or somebody who is in a different place geographically as well. And so that sort of characterizes all those different discourses. So I think that's sort of what they've got in common in where we are now. You mentioned sort of going back in time.
Yeah.
As we start going back in time, things shift quite a bit. So if I was doing quite a lot of work looking at framings of migration in the 1800s, for instance. And there it's actually nearly all about emigration. It's about movement out of the UK. And one of the really dominant metaphors then are metaphors around water. So, you know, references to flows of migration and managing the flows of migration. So in this sense, it's like a natural resource. And also around commodity. You know, there's a lot to do with the resources in the UK that can be used for empire in how they're framed. Of course, that's gone from where we are now. We've got similar things around commodity, of course, because we've got references to people smuggling and things like that, which assumes that the migrants are commodities for somebody. And all of those framings, right, around, you know, this is legislation that is enacted to protect, that it's about protecting people by them not travelling in the first place. I think that's sort of also very familiar in terms of that kind of undeserving, deserving distinction that I was mentioning, where very often you have this division of a group into the deserving and the undeserving. And the undeserving must be attacked, actually, in order to protect the deserving. And so it's almost like that division then serves to legitimate hostile actions against the whole group, just to make sure that you're getting, you know, the undeserving members of that group.
Yeah. And I guess historically, I mean, you're saying, you know, a lot of it in the older stuff was about emigration. But also, I suppose, in terms of immigration, different groups were foregrounded. So as you mentioned about, you know, Irish background, some of the kind of representations of Irish immigration are pretty appalling when you look back in the 1800s, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. And so that really feeds into this sort of cycles as well of, you know, how people are portrayed at the moment of arrival versus how they're portrayed a generation down the line.
So the other thing you've been looking at is discourses of nostalgia. So what does that involve and where does that fit in?
So the work on discourses of nostalgia really comes out from looking at migration discourses, actually for reasons we've just touched on, I suppose, in that it kind of started with this idea of the deserving and the undeserving migrant. And around 5 years ago, the Windrush scandal broke, which, you know, obviously you'll be familiar with and some people listening will. And it became evident that the UK government's so-called hostile environment policy was having very severe impacts on particular groups, including those who'd moved to the UK as British citizens, had lived here for decades, And suddenly we're in the position, because they couldn't prove their right to be in the UK for every year that they've been in the UK. You know, people were deported, they lost their jobs, they lost benefits to which they had the right to. And the government response to this was largely one along these lines of the deserving, undeserving migrant. So the Windrush generation were very much portrayed as the deserving migrants. They were described as being, you know, the builders of the UK. And they were contrasted with the undeserving migrants, who were those who were labelled as illegal immigrants at that point in time. And the whole discourse was that, you know, a net had to be cast for the undeserving migrants, and these unfortunate deserving migrants had been caught up in it. And, you know, as a linguist, you're listening to this, yeah, go, maybe, okay. And so I went back and looked at some of the historical corpora, and I looked at how the people who are now referred to as the Windrush generation were framed in the 1950s. So obviously it covers a wider period than that, but I focus on the 1950s because there was more data than in the 40s to try and work with, and it was a sort of fairly neat time period. And of course, what you found was that all of the metaphors that were used to talk about illegal immigrants in the present moment were the same that had been used to talk about the Windrush generation at the moment of arrival. You know, they were framed as invaders, they were framed as animals, all these sort of really offensive kinds of rhetorics being used. And there was nothing in common metaphorically in how they were framed at the moment of arrival and how they were framed in the moment in which the government was justifying their actions, right? So the only thing that holds that together as some kind of logical consistency is nostalgia. You know, it's a nostalgia for how the UK behaved towards these people who are now being held up as, you know, examples of good citizens, as a nostalgia for the state's reaction as well. And so that's kind of what led me into nostalgia. And then I started looking at, you know, do we have cycles of nostalgia then? So, you know, if the Windrush generation in the 50s were the undeserving migrants, well, who were the deserving migrants that they were being compared to? And then what you find, of course, is things like the Kinder Transport, who are kind of the ultimate deserving migrants in the British imagination. But only since about the 50s, you know, that they weren't being portrayed like that in the 40s.
No. Well, I mean, some pretty appalling mainstream media headlines about Jewish immigration, even from fleeing Hitler.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, you sort of go a step back and then, of course, you know, well, who's the deserving migrant for that group? And then, you know, beyond that, you're sort of going towards the Huguenots. And so you have these sort of steps back of this constant nostalgia for a previous group, which enables, legitimizes hostility towards the present group, because you've got that kind of defense ready that, oh, no, it's not that we're anti-migrants. We like this group. We just don't like this group here and now, essentially. Yeah. So it has that really strong rhetorical function. So yes, that's kind of what led me into nostalgia. But then once you start looking at it, like lots of things with discourse, it's everywhere. And, you know, nostalgia is, I would say, it's essential to any kind of a discourse which relies on a shared national identity, because the shared national identity has to rely on a shared history. And in order for that history to be shared by all members of the population, it's got to be partial, you know, and it's got to involve nostalgia and all of this cherry picking. But these are the moments we'll say we shared, and these other ones we'll just kind of brush them under the carpet a little.
And these become the British values that we are told to espouse.
Exactly, yeah. And all sorts of fascinating things. I mean, there was something on the radio the other day about, you know, listening to a politician being interviewed, and they were talking about, you know, the importance of Christian values, which have meant the country's always been stable. And like, oh,
right.
So, I mean, I do remember a war or two, you know, but yeah. So nostalgia, I think, is really central to anything to do with nationalism. It's got to involve nostalgia. And of course, nostalgia goes beyond that, but that's kind of the area that I find really fascinating with it.
I mean, maybe I'm being cynical. Stop me if I am. But would it be the case that these histories never really existed in the way that they were painted?
I mean, any story we tell about history is a story, right? We can't represent the entirety of history. It's not possible. So we're always going to be choosing elements that we choose to turn into narratives. And then those narratives become important to us as groups. But I think what's kind of interesting at this moment in time is the hostility to acknowledging that there are other ways of seeing that story or other stories around the same event. And that's quite interesting, this sort of really intense desire to for there to be a single narrative.
Right, yeah. And anything else is wokeness.
Yeah, it's a challenge.
Mm.
What are some of the main metaphors at work in the discourses that you've studied, and why are these so powerful?
So I guess there's sort of two quite contrasting ways, actually, that metaphors become really powerful. And I guess the first one is where the metadata goes under the radar and it's totally normalized. And we probably use them ourselves without really thinking that we've used them or noticing that we've used them. Mm. And so in relation to migration discourse, the obvious one there is the water metaphors, you know, references to flows of migration, waves of migration. And these sort of the specific lexicalizations have changed over the time. So people might not have said floods of migration in the 1800s, but, you know, they were using other things that referenced water. And I mean, what a metaphor like that does, the way it's used now, where it's nearly always things like floods and waves and these uncontrollable bodies of water, you know, what it's doing is it's taking a whole set of individuals and treating them as if they are a single object with a single kind of force and movement. Of course, that makes that single object seem much more powerful than just a group of individuals with individual reasons for being in the place that they are. And, you know, by making them as a single object, and a single object, that's nothing to do with, you know, being human, it's water. It takes away, you know, the humanness from how people have been portrayed. And also there's this interesting feature that I think when you start talking about, you know, the waves of migration, is that the people are permanently positioned as being outside the nation, right? So waves come to shore and then they go and they come and then they go. They're not integrated into the nation at any point. So there's something really interesting about that perpetual state of outsideness, even though often you're talking about people who are actually in the country, if you, you know, even hold that metaphor. So I think these are really powerful because we're so used to them that we don't really notice that we're using them. But then they can become, you know, operationalized for particular purposes, because if you've got an uncontrollable body of water, the logical response is, well, stop it, right? Yeah. And so once you've kind of snuck in these metaphors that position migrants as being an uncontrollable body of water, the response which is put forward, you know, you're stop the boats, has been legitimated by the metaphor that's already there. So I think metaphors do this really strong preparatory work. They're laying the ground, they're setting the discourse so that when a politician comes in with a new policy, it's not seen as a new policy, it's seen as a solution to an existing problem rather than, you know, a new direction. So yeah, it's established that there's a problem. I guess the other one that we've got that's sort of really heavily normalized is around migrants as objects. So, you know, references to sending people to a particular country, or the idea of, you know, migrant processing facilities, you know, these really are positioning them as objects. And that does the same sort of work. You know, it's treating them as a single entity. It is dehumanizing. And in that case, it legitimates particular actions, because once you sort of removed the humanness in some sense, then you're saying they're not entitled to the same level of treatment and human rights as other people who are in the same country, essentially.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier about kind of mainstream media representations. And I guess there's always been sort of fringe representations, which are much more offensive. Yes. There's a fairly good argument I've seen from lots of people that essentially a lot of that fringe has entered the mainstream, and the mainstream has actually can't be held as kind of innocent in this either. The mainstream has kind of adopted some of those as well. But you can, you know, things like you might expect Donald Trump to be anti-migrant, and he often is. And he used what actually, you know, was a very similar kind of phrasing to 1930s American anti-migrants, and also Hitler, when he talked about, you know, the immigration poisoning the blood of our nation. You even had, you know, Joe Biden, who you might not expect necessarily to be as extreme, talking about an illegal as a kind of term. You get some pretty extreme views from what would be normally seen as mainstream politicians in the UK now. So, as he said, the sort of stop the boats mantra and things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, has it always been this bad, or has it got worse recently?
Well, that's a good one. I mean, I think there's always been this history of offensive language being used towards immigrants who are moving here and now at that moment in time. And as we were just saying with that, when we were talking about nostalgia, there's also been this long history of a reevaluation, kind of a generation afterwards, of those people. So, I mean, there's definitely, we're not learning much, you know, as we go along. We're sort of repeating these same mistakes. So in that sense, that there is a sort of continuity within it. Having said that, yeah, I think we're at a really sort of particular moment where the rhetoric is coming from the centre of government. Mm-hmm. And I guess this goes back to sort of the power of the metaphors, right? So you've got the metaphors which go under the radar. And then the other way that metaphors are really powerful are the really striking ones. So these sort of deliberate metaphors. And, you know, we've seen this with some of the metaphors of migrants as animals as well, or as invaders, with Braverman a couple of years ago as well. Yeah. And so these ones, they're really effective because they get all the attention. And this is a problem a bit with our media, right? That somebody says something which is really obviously outrageous and it gets lots of attention, and that's exactly what they wanted from it. So, you know, there are sort of issues in there in terms of how we react to it. So I'd say that, yeah, I think in some ways that there is a sort of decline, where maybe the decline is more around not necessarily the language, but the where it's coming from, that it's coming from the center of government. And often it's around things which have actually been disproved. So there's sort of a questioning of evidence-based governance, I suppose. So, you know, associations around, I don't know, criminality, which have been disproved. The things around invasion. I mean, the proportion of people who were born outside the UK who arrived as refugees is tiny. You know, and so the idea that this is an invasion, you know, is actually sort of factually wrong. You know, it's something you can disprove, but that doesn't make any difference. The facts don't matter, because this is all about very emotive kind of storytelling in the way. So, yeah, I think there we could definitely talk about a decline. But I would say the flip side to that is that there's actually a really positive story going on, which isn't coming from discourse analysis, unfortunately, but it's coming from survey data and some of the work that's been done by Rob Ford at Manchester.
Right, yeah.
And it shows this consistent softening, let's say, of attitudes towards migration. So I think it was the 22 survey, around half of participants said they felt positively about immigration. And that was an increase already on, I think it's like a third of participants in 2014. So you've got this sort of general, you know, improvement of attitudes towards immigration, and it cuts across demographics. It's not just being led by one single group of people.
Right.
And so that actually poses a really interesting question. If we've got this kind of political rhetoric getting increasingly toxic, I suppose, but it's not reflecting the public mood. The public mood is increasingly sort of going, yeah, this is pretty much a good thing. Or I'm totally neutral about this. It's just a thing. So there's a really interesting thing there about the lack of responsiveness almost of the rhetoric to public survey data. And I guess another really positive thing, and this is slightly off topic, so I apologize, but it's that the survey data tends to show that where attitudes towards immigration are most hostile are the areas with lowest immigration.
Yes. Well, I'm sitting in Essex, and it's always been that kind of, you know, that's always been the sort of analysis I've read of it, is like kind of the sort of white flight territories, which they often refer to, like Essex. It's the people with the lowest areas of immigration who are kind of fearful and rely on their representations from a media that's clearly biased.
Yeah. And so this is a real argument why I think we need to challenge these really toxic discourses of immigration, is because it's really bad for everybody. Yeah. You know, it's really unpleasant to live your life feeling fearful of other people. So it's, you know, it has these really negative effects on a whole different sets of people in the population, obviously, and most evidently on people who are identified as migrants. In fact, whether they are or not is often sort of by the by, because of the ways that these things happen. But also on the people who are, you know, being positioned as this host population who are at risk.
And we're talking as well today, later on, to someone from the Migrants Rights Network, and they've got a campaign called Words Matter, which is really interesting. So how important are words in this? Or is it more about kind of structures, frames, whole ways of thinking?
It's got to be both, I think. I get quite annoyed sometimes when I hear people on the radio saying, oh, well, this debate about, you know, this politician said this, it doesn't matter. What matters is the policy. And it's like, no, these are the same thing. These things go together. We can't separate them out. So, and I guess there's like, at one level, the words are really important, because they're potentially sources just of disinformation, you know, and that's creating all sorts of problems. So, I mean, one example would be, you know, the avoidance of the term refugee, where that term is applicable, which is very prevalent in the UK, especially in the media and political circles. If you look at the collocates, the words that tend to go together with refugee, they all show you that people being talked about are not people in the UK. And when you are talking about, if you look for the nationalities of those people who you know are in the UK and have made requests for asylum, they're being described as migrants.
Yeah.
So that is a real, you know, piece of disinformation, in that people are being labelled in ways that ignore their legal rights. And similarly, the ways in which illegal migrant or illegal immigrant is being used in current political rhetoric as well. So it's being used to describe people who are applying for asylum, which is legal and something they have the right to do, in the only way that the UK government will allow them to do it, which is to travel to the UK and request asylum once they're in the UK. And that's the only possible way to do it. And yet they're framed as illegal immigrants, right? So this is one issue where naming is a real problem because it has, you know, kind of legal implications for the people who have been talked about and how we understand what they're doing. But then, you know, we've got this broader things around, you know, the names, in that one, they're telling us how people are conceptualizing the phenomenon. And then they're also shaping the way that we can think about it. And this is always the problem with discourse, right? That it's got that dual function going on. So if we're surrounded by discourses which frame people in particular ways, that's how we learn to talk about those ways. Until you encounter other ways of talking about them, that's what you've got available to you. So, you know, we're all influenced by the words that are used. And it's not to say that if you change the word and you say, oh, okay, you know, it's not acceptable to refer to an invasion of migrants, that will then change government policy. That's obviously going to be something else. But it's still important to do it because it's shaping how people are thinking about the phenomenon that is migration, you know, as a threat, essentially. So, yeah, I think words are really important because they're telling us something and because they're shaping how we as a society are thinking about that thing. But it's not sufficient to say change the word and you'll change the thinking. That's a different process that you've got to go through.
So if we do want to challenge some of these representations and use language to represent the world and people in less damaging ways, how can we do that? What advice could you offer? So somebody like George Lakoff, for example, has suggested different frames that we should use, kind of trying to alter our schema. Is that possible? How could we go about doing that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely what we need to do. So what I found a lot in my research, looking at how migration gets framed in the press, for instance, and comparing some of the more liberal press with the more right-wing press, is that actually we don't get alternative narratives, we don't get alternative framings in the liberal press. All we get is rejection or a challenging of what's going on in the right-wing press. And what that does is it just allows the agenda to be set by the right. And this, you know, very much falls into what Lakoff has talked about. And so there's a real issue there. And there's also this recent paper by Martin and Fosda where they look at the use of metaphors in anti-racism work in Australia and where people have been using these metaphors in order to challenge them. But then as they argue from looking at the data, the problem is that, you know, if you start to challenge them and say, oh, no, we're not being swamped, you're still allowing that premise to remain that if we were, that would be a bad thing. Mm. And that metaphor stays in place, right? That this is some kind of non-human action where people don't have agency and things. So it is really difficult. I think we do need new frames, new ways of talking about it. But then that raises the problem of where do you get them, right? And one of the reasons I started looking at the historical data was I thought I would find different ways of framing migration because I know attitudes have been so different in the past. And I didn't particularly. All the metaphors that I found in the past were present in the present, that there weren't any metaphors that had been lost that we could kind of go, okay, let's reclaim and reuse some of these. You know, they weren't always used in the same way through time, but they were all there. So that kind of didn't work. And a lot of the work I've done with other colleagues looking at cross-cultural work, we're finding really similar sorts of things across culture as well. I think one place maybe to start looking for new frames would be in self-representation and how people frame migration from the perspective of somebody who has moved, who's experienced migration, and so on. So there's work by Catalano, who looks at self-representation by migrants in the US, I think. And there she finds the metaphors that they're tending to use are around journey or cultivation, this idea of gardening as well. So there's a lot there that's kind of interesting.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah. But then I think, I don't know, the third point is also that even finding new frames means accepting the premise that migration is a newsworthy topic. So you're still somehow playing into an agenda that's been set by someone else who has an interest in setting that as an agenda. And this is one of the things that I keep coming back to is that, you know, if you're interested in looking in political discourse and media discourse and you're interested in positive representations of migration, I don't think you find it being labelled as migration. People just talk about my lovely neighbour, my, you know, amazing doctor or whatever. And the migrant element actually is unimportant then. So I think it's quite a tricky one if you want to be able to talk about migration while not accepting the premise that this is newsworthy or the premise that it's a problem that's been set out by those really dominant discourses coming at the moment, particularly from the right.
Yeah. I guess as well, you get that whole kind of thing where people say, you can't talk about migration, but they spend all their time talking about it.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and that goes back to, you know, the words matter thing, is that when you have these sort of concurrent discussions going forward where one is, oh, it doesn't matter what we say, why do people get so upset about words? And at the same time going, don't you dare use that. Yeah. And yeah, there was this really interesting debate when it was a few years ago that Al Jazeera issued this like really minor change to their style guide where they said they would no longer use migrant where refugee was the legally correct term. And then it'd be newspapers issue style guide changes and news agencies all the time. And this, like, you know, was huge news, and I spent too much time reading the comments underneath it. Ooh. And it was really interesting because it was very much made up of people going, why do we even want to do this? It doesn't matter what we call them. And the other half going, oh, we should call them. And then, you know, adding in slurs or animal metaphors and all of those sorts of things. So, you know, at the same time, it's like, it doesn't matter. And it really matters to make sense of the same groups, which I think is the similar sort of thing of, you know, oh, we can't talk about it. And we're talking about it all the time. Logic has no role in this, right? It's all about a particular emotive argument of I'm being silenced, I'm being squashed or whatever.
What would your advice be to students who want to explore and investigate the language of migration and how refugee and asylum seekers are represented? What are the most useful linguistic methods to use with either mainstream media, social media texts, you know, all these kind of channels that present this topic?
Well, first of all, I'd say it's a great topic choice. You know, it's a really, really rich area to go into. I guess my advice would be think broadly. And there are probably things that students could be looking at that I don't really even know about. And so I would say, think broadly. Don't just think about replicating things that you've seen. And I say, think broadly about, first of all, what do we mean by migration? So if you say you want to look at something on migration, where are we drawing the lines around migration? So, you know, what about if you have, I don't know, a big new housing development in your city? All the people who move into those houses are in some way migrants, right? They're all moving to a new place. So would that be a site of looking at migration, how that's being talked about? Or, you know, what about people who move within the UK, who move outside the UK, in terms of how migration is represented in different spheres? I think, you know, students could think broadly about that. They could think broadly about the kinds of texts. I was thinking of a paper I read recently by Sophia Lampropoulou, who looks in terms of media discourse at charity web pages, where they are doing, you know, really important work supporting migrants. But she was looking at the ways in which they themselves are framing migrants. So I think they're really interesting media kind of texts to look at as well. And you could think broadly about whose perspective, thinking about the migrants' own perspectives on that process and how they represent the host, so-called host population and the process of migrating. So yeah, I think there's a huge array of things that people could look at. And I would say to students, yeah, think broadly about where you want to go with it. In terms of linguistic methods, I guess things that I've used and found particularly useful would be things like social actor analysis from Van Leeuwen. Yeah. So looking at how groups of people get named, who gets named with a name, who gets collectivized in a group, who gets described in this kind of classified way, like the Biden example you mentioned earlier, like, you know, illegals. Illegals is an interesting example because, again, it's a dehumanized one. We've taken out the element of human, which would be there with migrant, and they're just left with this classification. So I think social actor analysis is really helpful. And it also gives students a way into the data. It gives you something really concrete to start looking at in that set. Hand in hand with social actor analysis, I guess, would be transitivity. You know, who is performed as doing something? Who has things done to them? Yeah. So I think what's really interesting, a lot of the discussion of migration discourses, I guess, is the way in which you've got these sort of distinctions in the more aggressive kind of metaphors like invader. The migrants are positioned with a great deal of agency, you know, that they're coming and they're performing violent actions. But actually, most of the migration discourses often frame migrants as not having agency. And it focuses very much on reasons for coming to the UK rather than reasons for leaving another place. Or in fact, it focuses on a subset of reasons for coming to the UK. Often, you know, interestingly for linguists, one that ignores language, the fact that it's very often people who are speak English for all sorts of reasons. Yeah. It's a really nice paper by Simon Goodman that looks at binary oppositions, you know, this kind of deserving, undeserving opposition, and the ways in which people get categorized. And he was saying, well, you know, we could think about alternative categorizations, you know, how would it feel if people were categorized in terms of, do they come from a post-colonial context or not? You know, and how would that change the kind of discourse around migration? So yes, I think social actor analysis, transitivity, binary opposition, I think is really interesting. Also, you know, at the sort of micro level, looking at the texts, and do you have the people who are positioned as migrants being opposed to some other group? So, you know, it might be a reference to things like economic migrants or refugees, and that "or" is saying these are two different groups of people. So they could do that kind of close reading work of who are they being opposed to, I think. Metaphor, I've got to say. Metaphor is really fascinating. I think metaphor can lead you to find all sorts of things that are not necessarily overt as well, which is really fascinating.
I
guess the other thing, going back to where we started with corpus linguistics, we're looking at collocation, you know, just starting off with that really sort of data-driven thing of, okay, well, what if I take these terms like migrant or expat or whatever it's going to be and say, what other words go together with these? And what do these tell me about how these people are being categorized and packaged up for us in this kind of discourse? So I think that would be a kind of a different way of approaching it, but coming through that corpus lens could be really interesting.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, I could see Raj getting very enthused by social actor theory. That's one of your favorites, isn't it?
Yes, it's one of my big things. Yeah,
is it?
Yes.
What question would you like us to ask the person from the Migrants' Right Network this afternoon? Can you think of a useful question we could ask her?
Oh, I guess from her perspective, you know, she'd have more insight, I suppose, on what she thinks gains traction, maybe.
Right.
And that would be really interesting. If we're thinking about how do we challenge these discourses, what does she feel actually, you know, gets a bit of momentum?
Right. Going? Okay.
That would be an interesting one.
Right. Okay. No, we'll do. That sounds good. Yeah. Thank you for that. So should we just go to the quick fire ones? There's so many more things I'd like to ask you, but it's not fair to...
I don't want to know what Raj does with social actor theory, but yeah, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to ask that here.
So what's your favourite book about language?
So I found this really difficult, actually. There wasn't a single book that came to mind. So I kind of went for the one that's sitting on my desk at the moment. And it's the second edition of the book that I recommend to everybody who wants to do anything with corpus linguistics applied to discourse analysis. So it's this one. It's by Paul Baker, and it's called Using Corpora in Discourse Analysis. Yeah. And I've got the second edition there. But the first edition is also great. And generally speaking, I really like Paul Baker's writing. You know, he writes in this really super accessible way about really interesting things. So it would probably have had to have been one of his books. I decided to go for this one because it is the one I recommend the most, probably.
Yeah, so we know that I'm interested in social actor theory. This whole kind of idea of who is kind of given agency, where is agency kind of completely, not necessarily removed as such, but just kind of deleted from any kind of phraseology, etc. What would your favourite linguistic fact or idea be?
Ooh, I suppose as a discourse analyst, I have to say it's this way in which language has this dual function of reflecting and shaping society at the same time. I mean, that to me is like right at the centre of what makes it so powerful. And it's also what makes it so difficult to investigate as well, because when we're thinking about discourses that are naturalized, that we ourselves are part of and replicating, it's really difficult to see that that is a discourse. It's not the only way of constructing or thinking or talking about that particular phenomenon. So for me, that's something that's really central that I find fascinating.
What one bit of advice would you give a budding linguist?
Well, it was literally one bit. It would be curious, I think. You know, there's so much out there that is, you know, fascinating to look at. And for me, one of the really interesting things about linguistics is that basically intersects with every other discipline in the humanities and social sciences. So, I mean, for a lot of people, the most obvious intersection would be with literature, especially people who've done, you know, joint courses on language and literature. But, you know, it's speaking to history, it's speaking to philosophy an awful lot. It's speaking to human geography, it's speaking to psychology. So I'd say, you know, really be curious and think broadly about what it means to do linguistics and follow up the things you're interested in. And I guess, part of being curious is also sort of bringing in the things that you're noticing around you. And they're probably things that are quite salient because you're noticing them, right? And then that might be the seed of something really interesting that you can go and investigate. So one of the things I got really interested in is impoliteness, and I'm really fascinated by verbal aggression. And again, that sort of came from observations in some way of thinking, what's this point where suddenly impoliteness is entertainment? You know, what's going on with that? And then from there, you know, there was a whole set of things I got really interested in. But yeah, be curious. Just go and find out more about the things that sort of you've noticed or the things that strike you. So yeah.
Great. Well, thanks very much. That's really great. There's masses of stuff there.
It's so interesting. That's why I said, you know, I sort of got the time that, you know, you've got. I can talk about this all day.
So also on this episode, Alexis, which is a two-header, we are going to be talking to Anna Ravala, who is Communications Officer of the Migrants' Rights Network. So welcome, Anna, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we previously talked on this episode to Professor Charlotte Taylor about discourses around migration. So we're talking about representation, language, and migrants and migration in general for this episode.
Okay, so can you tell us a bit about the Migrants' Rights Network and the work that you do? And what led you to get involved with it?
So Migrants' Rights Network, or MRN, is a majority migrant and POC-led charity. And our whole remit is, our whole aim is standing in solidarity with all migrants, including refugees, in their fight for rights and justice. We're lived experience-led and values-led. And at MRN, we're all about challenging issues at the root and really understanding the racism, Islamophobia, and colonialism that underpins contemporary migration discourse. We're collaborative in our approach. And we also use a lens of intersectionality. And our whole work is premised around the idea that we can't understand migration without understanding how race and colonialism and Islamophobia are central to it. So race and Islamophobia defining who gets constructed as a migrant, and also defining and shaping which migrants are welcomed and which aren't, and how colonialism causes migration and displacement, and also how colonial narratives define who is welcome and who isn't. And our main aim is we want a world where people are free to move, but also a world where no one is forced to move. And we want a world without oppression, a world where no one's safety and dignity is taken away because of their immigration status. And we achieve this through our work on various areas. So we strive for transformational systemic change. And we do this through our work on our campaign called The Hostile Office, which exposes the racist, colonial, violent origins of the Home Office. We also expose employment exploitation, and we do lots of work on the hostile digital environment, which looks at the enforcement of immigration enforcement, like digitally. We also want to ensure that migrants are their own change makers and that they have the information and tools necessary to do that. So we have various rights guides. We also have a migrant aspiration program, which is a leadership program. And we also have an amazing network of experts by lived experience. Our sort of main, our final main strand is on defining the narrative. And we have two campaigns to that effect. So our Words Matter campaign, which is what we're going to be speaking a lot about today, which is on defying mainstream narratives on migration that are used to harm migrants, and basically explaining why certain terms are harmful and what terms to use instead. And it's, yeah, targeted generally to the general public, to those who would use, those who are right-leaning or right-wing, but also those who are well-meaning and don't necessarily realise the negative effects of the language they're using. And our other campaign, Who is Welcome, looks at, you know, the intersection of migration with other areas. So how racism, Islamophobia, queerphobia, how these things all intersect with migration. Generally, we stand in solidarity with all groups amongst increased scapegoating and hostility and these really detrimental anti-migrant policies that are increasingly being brought in by the government. And my specific role is I'm the communications officer. So I create visual and written content for our social media channels, website and newsletter in the form of blogs and graphics. I got involved in MRN because the cause is personal to me. I'm a second generation migrant, or the child of migrants. And because I really believe in the power of storytelling through communication and creativity.
I think we were in conversation earlier with Charlotte Taylor, who was, you know, she's done lots of studies about the representation of migration in the media. And whenever migration is covered in the UK press, it's a horror show, really, isn't it? It's invariably as part of a crisis. And if you look back through history, I'm sure, you know this as well as others, that it's, Irish migration in the famine, Jewish migration, sort of late 19th, early 20th century, Windrush, Ugandan and Kenyan Asians, Vietnamese boat people, EU workers, et cetera, et cetera. Any kind of movement of people, and we won't say wave, because wave is a metaphor that we've discussed on the previous interview, which is a bit of a problem. But whenever there's a significant movement of people, the media represents them in really quite kind of damaging ways. What is it about migration that the press finds so problematic?
So there's a number of reasons why they present migration in this way, like why they present it primarily through the language of, to quote, crisis. Mm. And there's loads of different reasons for this. They do this, so the media and the government, they want to blame migrants. And the whole issue with the language of crisis is that it shifts, it's very effective at shifting blame onto people who are migrating, instead of questioning why they're having to make dangerous journeys in the first place. And that's because of lack of safe routes that forces people into taking dangerous journeys. And so the outrage is misplaced, because it should really be on these dangerous routes and not the legal designation of such routes. And there's another reason why. So they also do this because they want to try and, I guess, evade, get away from the responsibility of having to help out, because the language of crisis is also very effective at erasing colonial violence from our history. So the global South, which is the rest of the world outside of Europe and the West, has been colonized by Europe. And the effects of this, political instability, war, poverty, climate change, people are moving to escape these conditions. But government, especially our government, try to paint people moving as being independent from this colonial past, when in fact it's entirely dependent on it. And we all owe each other compassion by virtue of being human. But the government tries to hide the causes of displacement, because if they accept the causes, i.e. that they're the ones causing it, it means they're even more responsible and have even more of a duty and obligation to help out. Another reason why they do it is that they try to distract from their own failures. So blaming migrants obviously allows the government, allows media to scapegoat them. So they're blamed for the various number of problems we have in the UK. They're blamed for cost of living crisis, homelessness and poverty. And it's much easier to blame a migrant than the people at the top who are hoarding all the wealth, than the people responsible for austerity measures. And using the language of crisis makes it seem like migrants are the problem instead of the government, who is actually responsible for all these issues. And I guess the final reason why they want to blame and scapegoat migrants is because if you are painting migrants in such a negative way, you can then justify horribly inhumane, racist and Islamophobic policies against them. So it's important to realize that this language of crisis, this demonization, is that there are so many reasons why this is done, and ultimately it's to justify increasingly harsh and really repressive policies against migrants, including refugees. It's also important to note that not all migration is viewed by the government as a crisis, and this plays out along racial lines, essentially, because the white Ukrainians coming to this country weren't seen as a crisis, but anyone who is racialized as black or brown who's coming, that is then seen as a crisis. So it's important to see how it's not applied consistently as well.
What are the main patterns you've observed in the representation of migrants in the UK media, and maybe even extending beyond the UK?
So there were quite a few strands to this. So I've just picked out the key ones that I think are most important. But so firstly, there's the really obviously racist and demonizing language, like the language of invasion, the language of wave, as you touched on earlier, the language of swarm, influx, threat, illegal, like all these terms. And this language is often used against racialized migrants, Black, brown, and Muslim migrants, in order to dehumanize them, compare them to animals, and to justify more and more borders and exclusionary immigration policies. And this language also has its roots in, you know, what colonizers used to say about the people they were colonizing, that they're, you know, quote unquote, a threat or savage or uncivilized and all these things. Then there's another strand, like, you know, like beyond merely the words that are being used to describe migrants, there's also the way that images are used, like photos of like big groups of migrants are used deliberately to dehumanize them, to sort of get rid of their individuality. And they're also shown in their moments of, you know, suffering or starvation, which is non-consensual. And it's something called trauma voyeurism, which is when we consume images of people suffering in a, you know, which is really extractive, unethical, and disrespectful, and ultimately desensitizes us to the most violent of events, which is really dangerous. So then back to language, there's a deliberate separation of migrants from refugees. And it's really important remembering that refugees are a type of migrant. So migrant, the term migrant includes refugees, undocumented migrants, asylum seekers, and loads of other communities. And this separation is done deliberately because refugees, and this is a generalization, but refugees tend to be seen as more deserving of protection because it's deemed that they had no choice. They're seen as the right kind of migrant. But those who are deemed, and this is a problematic term, economic migrants or even asylum seekers, even though they're both migrants, they're not seen to have a legitimate reason to be here. Or it's very much this idea that they might have come here by choice and that that justifies treating them badly. But there's many legitimate reasons why people move, even if they aren't recognized as, even if they aren't being recognized as refugees. And that's why, like, we at MRM, we don't say migrants and refugees, because that solidifies the separation. We say migrants, including refugees. Another really key area is the way that binaries are consistently being used, especially in pro-migration arguments. So what I mean by binaries is this idea, you know, like this distinction between someone contributing and someone not contributing, someone being genuine and not genuine, someone integrating and not integrating, someone adhering to British values and someone not doing that. And binaries are rooted in, so it's about only, you know, treating migrants with respect if they're fulfilling certain conditions. So this idea that we should only accept them if they're, you know, hardworking, contribute, integrate, or adhere to British values, whatever that means. Because it's not unconditional respect, because it's conditional, it's not respectful. It also raises implications, like it's insulting to disabled communities. Because not everyone can economically contribute. Integration, that language has been rejected a lot by, you know, racial justice movements. And it's important for the migration sector to keep up with that, because we see a lot of times that, you know, people who say they're on the side of migrants, they will use the language of integration. And that's something that, you know, we think is really harmful. And we've learned that from the lessons that racial justice movements have taught us. And yeah, integration like forces people to give up essential elements of their identity. So that's also like harmful. And these binaries also mean that, you know, migrants who aren't seen to be fulfilling certain criteria, and they're oftentimes Black or brown or Muslim, they're then treated badly. And we also need to interrogate the idea of British values as well, because, yeah, you know, says it treats people with respect and that it respects liberty. But, you know, an analysis of its past and present actions shows this to be false. And like the final strand, I guess, is migrants are often by governments and by the media framed in a way that denies them their agency. So they're described as, you know, being vulnerable or voiceless to get people to feel sorry for them. And pity is kind of condescending, because ultimately what we should be showing is solidarity. Pity is dehumanizing and patronizing. And the idea of voicelessness as well is used a lot in animal activist circles, like this whole, I'll give a voice to the voiceless. So it's really dehumanizing to talk about human beings in this way. And relating to vulnerability, you know, like it's important to emphasize that migrants aren't vulnerable, like inherently, they're just made vulnerable by harmful systems that are putting them at risk. So there was a lot of different strands there, but those are like...
Yeah, no, it's really interesting to hear you sort of working in the field. Lots of those things are exactly the sort of things that Charlotte was talking about in the previous interview, about those sort of patterns that she's observed through, you know, linguistic analysis of lots of media resources. So it's really interesting to see that that's sort of borne out both ways. Yeah, I mean, the British values thing is an interesting one, particularly we're recording this today while Michael Gove is in Parliament kind of basically saying that anybody who doesn't espouse British values, whatever they are, is an extremist. So that's a barrel of laughs for us. So you mentioned the Words Matter campaign, and that was the kind of thing that struck me about the work you do. I mean, to be honest, I'd heard about MRM before, but I hadn't really kind of looked in any great detail at the sort of work you did. But I was really impressed with the Words Matter campaign because it suggested a kind of focus on the power of language and people working in the field seeing it as powerful. So could you give us some examples of the kinds of language that need changing and why? I know you've mentioned about, you know, migrant, refugee and avoiding binaries. Are there any particular terms that you think are particularly salient here?
I mean, there's a lot. Like, in general, you know, as I've touched on, that demonizing language is a massive problem because that then justifies migrants being oppressed. There's obviously, you know, the term illegal, which is really dehumanizing and also like raises questions as to, you know, why is migration being criminalized? And we need to reflect on people and actions that are being criminalized because criminalization doesn't always reflect what's morally wrong and legalization doesn't always reflect what is morally right. And we've seen this countless times throughout history. So that's like a big one. As I mentioned before, like the kind of words that are used to pit groups against each other, like based on a binary, those are also like really harmful. There's also this idea of like safe countries that is like being used a lot. And the government uses this idea to essentially deny people sanctuary. So it tries to send asylum seekers back to their home countries or to Rwanda by arguing that these places are safe. But in the context of these people have fled those countries precisely because they aren't safe. So yeah, and like nowhere is safe essentially if you're forced to go there against your will. And that's pretty much what the government wants to be doing, sending people somewhere against their will. And safety is all relative. Like it's not just about being somewhere where there's no war or conflict. Is also about, like, you know, not being subjected to oppression wherever you are. So people should be able to live where is most safe for them, and that varies from person to person. So who is the government to say this place is safe? And another really big issue at the moment, actually, it's this language of like something being expensive. So we're seeing people's main argument against deporting people to Rwanda is that it's like quote unquote expensive. And to us this is quite shocking because it's like our main argument against deporting people should be that deportations are cruel and inhumane. And people who say, oh, you know, it's expensive, don't realize that then, okay, so if it was cheap or if it was free to do that, their argument would fall apart. Are they saying that they would be pro deportation if it's cheap? Like, is that what they're saying? So people need to be really careful about the arguments they make, and they need to base their arguments on morality, not on cost, because those are kind of arguments just fall apart.
Yeah.
We really need to get away from viewing, like, always talking about migrants through this idea of like numbers and, you know, oh, it's not that many that are coming, or, you know, like it's this amount that are coming, because it's like people are more than numbers. We wouldn't refer to anybody else in this way, like through numbers. So why are we doing it? Like it just shows how deeply like capitalism is in society, to the point that, you know, everyone is viewed in terms of a figure or the value that they can offer. And it's really important that we like do everything that we can to like chip away at this kind of framing.
Like humans as commodities kind of thing.
Yeah.
If we're thinking about particular words which are incredibly problematic, you know, we have this kind of sense that, well, we should be able to then ideally change the language so that we can eradicate those issues and those problems. But one of the criticisms we have about, you know, calling for language to change is that Well, that is essentially seen as a form of language policing that tells people what they can and can't say. So obviously people are going to kick back against that sort of aspect. And alongside that, it's, you know, kind of by kind of suggesting that language is responsible for sort of those aspects, it's easier to target that than perhaps actually the root causes of thinking about the policy and the action, which has perhaps led to some of these ideas or these kind of representations in the first place. What do you make of those criticisms when we are thinking about calls to change language to make it less discriminatory, less prejudicial?
So I have so much to say on this. So like firstly, on the point with policing, firstly, suggesting someone change their language doesn't actually force them to do that. Secondly, the people who would call our Words Matter campaign language policing don't really care about, you know, like pro-Palestinian activists being silenced or critical race theory being censored. So there's a clear double standard. Like, people only care about language being policed when the language they're being encouraged to use is too, and I quote, woke for them. Like, they don't like that they're being called out for using racist or transphobic language, essentially. And thirdly, people are free to say what they want, but freedom to say what you want doesn't mean freedom from consequence. So if your language is hateful, then holding someone to account for using hateful or harmful language isn't policing them, it's just holding them into account, because hate speech isn't free speech. And I wish people would stop like conflating the two, because completely different. And you know, like lastly on that point, like our Words Matter campaign is actually against policing, surveillance and demonization that, you know, are directly bolstered by harmful narratives. So we're fighting against policing. We want respect and liberation, which in our eyes is the opposite of policing. And so on the point about language being an easier thing to address than challenging policy, I mean, I would say firstly that, you know, words are actually so important and directly relate to policy, because, you know, the words and the narratives that we use and talk about, they reveal our views and attitudes on people and on the world. And it's these views and attitudes that then dictate what policies get passed and what policies don't, because the policies are passed by people who have certain views and attitudes. So harmful words legitimize and normalize harmful policies. They allow these harmful policies to happen. And I would actually argue that changing words and changing attitudes is actually a lot harder than changing a policy, because if you have like 10 racist policies and the government overturns one of them, which they'll usually only do to get you to be quiet and to think that racism is over, you're still going to be left with 9 racist policies, and you're still left with the racist attitudes that made those 10 racist policies possible in the first place. So changing a policy in isolation doesn't actually get to the root of the issue, which is racism or anti-migrant sentiment, Islamophobia, but stamping out racist words and the attitudes that, you know, they represent does get to the root. And it's also important to remember the way that power works in our societies is that it manufactures consent for really horrible things. So those in power, they'll demonize a group of people for long enough that everyone in society then starts to believe it. And when these horrible laws are passed, everyone thinks that these laws are justified because they're essentially brainwashed to believe the bad things that have been said about this particular marginalized group. But then if you're changing attitudes, and if you do this on a wide enough scale, and changing words that people use comes under that, even if harmful policies are getting passed, you have made people understand that they have to resist them because the narratives that they're built on are false. So if those in power can't manufacture consent from the public for these harmful policies, they lose their power. So that's why we need to change narratives, because by changing narratives, we are defying power, because we're refusing to consent to the government's policies and to the narratives that it espouses about different marginalized communities. Yeah, so that's what I would say about.
Lots of linguists would say words are actions. You know, if you promise something or you swear something, that's an action. And, you know, lots of words used to describe groups can be a kind of seen as an action as well, can't they? In terms of the, you know, the choice you've made to label someone in a certain way has an effect on how they feel about themselves.
100%. And also, like, words could actually, like, harmful words directed against someone can actually, like, significantly, like, psychologically traumatize someone as well. So it's also worth pointing that out. It's just, you know, physical assault that hurts people, like verbal assault really hurts as well.
We asked our previous interviewee, Charlotte Taylor about what she might want to ask from this sort of perspective. And she was interested to know what sort of types of language around migration actually gain traction and work and have a positive effect in your experience.
That's a really good question. I think, so it's not specific words per se that work, like that I would say work, but rather than like more general like statements or attitudes underpinning a group of words or a sentence or a statement. But we've seen like, I mean, obviously the whole no one is illegal, I think works quite well. But also we've seen recently, because we have been putting out like explainers quite recently, we've seen that people responded quite well to, you know, like our explainer of like with the language of like expensive or unworkable. And essentially like our whole tagline was with that was, you know, cost isn't the issue, morality is. So it's really about making people understand like the issue with certain things isn't that they cost too much or they won't work or they're not going to be practical, but rather the fact that, you know, they're inhumane and cruel and just awful. So I think it's about, I think language that works kind of gets to the root of what is causing the problem or who is causing the problem, which is the government, and how it's the government that's actually like responsible for like scapegoating certain groups, pitting them against each other, creating these divides deliberately in order to distract from its own like policy failings, and actually realizing, championing like language around like interconnectedness. So realizing that, you know, like our struggles are all really deeply connected, and that, you know, the average like normal person, like we have more in common with someone who's, you know, like extremely marginalized, who's an asylum seeker, than we do with people in power. So it's about understanding that as well, because in a sense, our rights could be stripped away at any moment, like no matter who we are. And it's also that these narratives, these attitudes that, you know, define who is worth of respect and who isn't, they manifest themselves in racist ways, in ableist ways, in classist ways, in homophobic ways. So it's really important to see that it's just the same patterns being used, and the government will always scapegoat different groups. They did it to Jewish people. They did it to Muslims. They did it to queer people. They did it to migrants, and they're still doing it to loads of different groups. So it's about realizing that this is just like a pattern, and we've seen it before, and we can see through why they're doing it. Essentially. Yeah.
What would your suggestions be to people, educators, students, anyone who wants to effect change in their own communities?
Again, there's like so much to say here, but I would say, you know, just understanding the centrality of racism and colonialism and Islamophobia and all these multiple systems of oppression in, you know, shaping migration and also shaping migration discourse. Yeah, understanding the interconnectedness of all of our struggles, understanding the importance of class as well. So like middle class people have a lot more in common with someone who is homeless than with someone who is a billionaire, like that kind of thing as well. Understanding that we have to operate from a place that is against all these different forms of oppression, including capitalism, because that's responsible for, you know, like dehumanizing us all to varying extents. Another important one is, I mean, understanding that lived experience is important, but also that lived experience can be weaponized. And it doesn't always mean that someone will have progressive values. And we see that with, you know, like people in government who are black or brown, who, you know, espouse policies that directly harm the communities that they have grown up in. So, you know, that's a really important thing to think about as well. Like lived experience is so often weaponized in order to shut down criticism. And yeah, that's something that everyone should like be aware of. And I guess understanding it's like, if you want to affect change, like what is your horizon of change? Like, is your horizon merely reforming, which doesn't get to the root of issues, or is it like decolonization, is it liberation? Because, you know, like white supremacy like shapes exclusionary migration legislation, and that's a defining feature of like modern day bordering. And so when we reform, especially in this sector, like when we reform or we tweak like a policy or a system, we don't question why it exists in the first place, and we fail to interrogate how the modern world is built on white supremacy. And so why are we just content to like reform or tweak it. And I'll give like a specific example. So like there's campaigns in our sector that have called for like a 28-day limit for detention, as opposed to the current, you know, thing of indefinite detention. And whilst reducing the time that someone's held in detention may seem like a logical change to seek, it also like reinforces the idea that detention is acceptable and like necessary on like some level, that harm is acceptable on some level. So like reforms just don't challenge the oppression itself, and they allow oppressive status quo to replicate itself. So I guess what it comes down to is like, when you want to make change, like it's important to think about, can you change a system that was never designed to serve you in the first place? Or does it need to be like dismantled and replaced with something else? And we would argue that no, you can't change something that was never meant to like serve you in the first place. And again, like for people working in charities or who want to work in charities, I guess decolonization is like a buzzword, but we have to understand, you know, what that truly means. And like decolonizing the charity sector, it means working towards making ourselves obsolete and no longer necessary, because, you know, our work has to undermine and seek to get rid of the oppressive systems that are necessitating our existence. Otherwise, you know, like our work is counterproductive.
No, that's really interesting. No, thanks very much. I mean, it's some really, really detailed and linguistically interesting responses as well for A-level students to you know, doing this, as well as interesting from, you know, so much other stuff.
Thanks very much to Charlotte and Anna for their interviews, and we'll be back very soon with another one about language education in secondary schools.